The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. And this week, I'm reading from the edition dated September 9th, 2011. And our first item from the main story section of the Week magazine this week is entitled Hurricane Irene and the Aftermath. What happened? Irene, the most powerful hurricane to reach the East Coast in two decades, lashed some of the country's most densely populated areas with 85-mile-per-hour winds and torrential rains, killing at least 40 people and causing more than $10 billion in property damage. Anticipating the storm, state and local officials had ordered massive coastal evacuations from North Carolina to Connecticut. The cities of Washington, Philadelphia, and New York were brought to a standstill. The region's airports were closed and more than 10,000 flights were canceled. Forecasters and news teams obsessively tracked the course of the monster storm of the century. Recalling the lessons of Katrina, President Obama cut short his vacation and returned to Washington before Irene blew ashore. New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg took to the airwaves, warning of worst-case scenarios and shutting down Broadway theaters and the subways. "Get the hell off the beach," thundered New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who evacuated Atlantic City and other towns on the Jersey Shore. As Irene swept into New York and New England, it was downgraded to a tropical storm, sparing well-prepared cities, but causing extensive flooding in suburbs and inland rural areas. "Vermont has a full-blown flooding catastrophe on its hands," said Governor Peter Shumlin. The Federal Emergency Management Agency halted rebuilding projects dating back to Katrina in order to rush emergency aid to victims of Irene, which is likely to rank among the 10 costliest catastrophes in U.S. history. Here's what the editorial said. "It appears that the emergency preparedness paid off," said the Boston Globe. "Public safety workers performed courageously, power companies did triple shifts, and even TV news crews helped convince people to move to shelters. Lives were spared because forecasters delivered timely, actionable information. It's wise to remember these successes at a time when the National Weather Service is being demeaned as a bureaucratic frill. Still, there are legitimate questions about the scaremongering media coverage," said the Philadelphia Inquirer. "Could we have avoided the inconvenience of mass evacuations at the cost of shutting down businesses? Perhaps, but there are no reports of anyone actually being harmed by hurricane hype." "Besides, it's not hype if it's your house that's flooded," said the Newark, New Jersey Star-Ledger. "Thousands are still homeless, and more than 4 million people still had no power days after the storm hit. But we've taken the worst of what Irene threw at us, and we're still standing. The fact that everyone took this threat seriously is a big reason." Now here's what the columnist said. "Big government finally got one right," said Dana Milbank in the Washington Post. "It was the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's satellites and tracking software that predicted the path of the storm to within 10 miles. Federal emergency teams deployed from Florida to Maine assisted local governments with food, water, and generators. Like the taking out of Osama bin Laden, this is a reminder that government can still do great things." "Actually, it was local government that came through here," said Jim Lacey in NationalReview.com. "From governors on down to town mayors and county councilmen, government officials were doing what they are paid to do. There was no civil breakdown, no need for the military, as there was with Katrina in 2005. To local officials, all I can say is great job all around. For this, I don't mind paying taxes." Plenty of conservatives are balking, though, at spending money on federal disaster relief, said Brad Plummer in the WashingtonPost.com. This week, Representative Eric Cantor of Virginia said that Congress would have to cut other programs to offset the cost of relief for Irene, setting the tone for acrimonious debates. With FEMA's coffers already depleted by this year's spate of tornadoes and floods, a divided Congress will now have to either pass supplemental spending bills or start choosing among disaster victims. Costs for natural disasters are sure to rise with more of us living in coastal areas and a warmer planet producing more extreme precipitation events. We ought to come up with a way to keep disaster relief funding from being such a haphazard affair. Our next item from the main story section is Zero Hour in Libya. Shouts of Libya is free rang out in Tripoli's central square this past week as thousands of Libyans celebrated the overthrow of Colonel Muammar al-Qaddafi. Beyond the capital, the fight against the fugitive dictator's forces appeared to be entering its final stages. As the week went to press, rebels were preparing to launch an assault on Sirte, Qaddafi's birthplace and the last major bastion of regime support. Zero hour is quickly approaching, said rebel official Colonel Ahmed Omar Bani. Qaddafi's whereabouts are still unknown, though. Some rebels speculated that the despot was hiding in Sirte, while others contended that he had fled across the border to Algeria, which this week took in his wife, his daughter, and two of his sons. Rebel officials demanded their return for trial, calling Algeria's decision to host the family an aggressive act against the Libyan people's wish. Qaddafi is all but beaten, said Dirk van der Waal in the DailyBeast.com. Can the rebels now win the peace? The fact that their fledgling government, the Transportation National Council, has shown a skill for statecraft should inspire optimism. It has established diplomatic relations with dozens of countries, drawn up a constitution, and developed detailed plans for elections and for dealing with the incendiary issues of retribution and justice. To achieve all this in the midst of a civil war and with scant resources is hugely impressive. But corralling Libya back into a state of law and order won't be easy, said Kristen Chick in CSMonitor.com. Some rebels are unlikely to heed any central government's calls to disarm. There are old scores to settle against regime loyalists, some of whom were apparently killed last week with their hands bound. The patchwork rebel alliance could also divide along tribal lines. With so much chaos, it's impossible for Qaddafi to get a fair trial in Libya, said Jeffrey Robertson in the London Guardian. So if the rebels ever catch the tyrant, they should hand him over to the International Criminal Court in The Hague. That would promote law and order in Libya by showing that justice trumps revenge and send a chilling signal to all other governments tempted to kill their own people. Our next item, in a related article, another blow for al-Qaeda. A CIA drone has killed al-Qaeda's number two, Atiyah Abd al-Rahman, in the remote mountains of Pakistan, further weakening the terror group after the death of Osama bin Laden. Rahman, a Libyan, fought against the Soviets in Afghanistan as a teenager and eventually rose to become al-Qaeda's commander for Pakistan's tribal areas. He took over as the group's top operations planner last year and was in frequent contact with bin Laden. While Aman al-Zawahiri claimed nominal leadership of the network after a Navy SEAL team killed bin Laden in May, the younger Rahman was seen as the rising star of a new generation of terrorists. He combined the skills of a diplomat, an operator, and a strategist. Will McCants, an al-Qaeda expert at the Center for Naval Analysis, told Wired, "For that reason, he was one of bin Laden's closest confidants." Rahman's death may actually have a larger impact on al-Qaeda than bin Laden, said Brian Fishman in Foreign Policy. He was not the ultimate decision maker, but he was the information crossroads. He was able to communicate with al-Qaeda members in Iran as well as with the al-Qaeda faction in Iraq, which has ties to those in Africa. That's why his death will cripple al-Qaeda's ability to function as a covert network. And just in time, said David Ignatius in the Washington Post, Rahman had been working on a big strike against a U.S. target to mark the 10th anniversary of 9/11. While it's unclear how far that planning had progressed, it will be hampered, maybe even disrupted, by the death of the man whom bin Laden charged with organizing the plot. Still, it's too early for an end zone celebration or a mission accomplished banner, said the Chicago Tribune in an editorial. Only our intense concentration on hunting down and taking out al-Qaeda operatives has prevented another atrocity on American soil. Now is no time for complacency. Al-Qaeda may have had a bad year, but like a wounded rattlesnake, it remains very dangerous. And now we'll turn to the controversy of the week in the Week magazine. It's entitled Politics and Faith, A Troublesome Marriage. We need to scrutinize the religious beliefs of our would-be president, said Bill Keller in the New York Times. Several of the Republican presidential candidates belong to churches that are mysterious or suspect to many Americans, yet we are too squeamish to press for details. Evangelical Christians, Rick Perry and Michelle Bachmann, for example, have links to Dominionist preachers who teach that only Christians should hold public office. Do the candidates believe that? I don't know, but let's ask. We can't run the risk of our next president being a theocrat who puts the Bible ahead of the Constitution. We're running that risk already, said Maggie Astor in the International Business Times. Judging by their fire and brimstone rhetoric, neither Bachmann nor Perry has much respect for the separation of church and state. If voters believe in the principles on which America was founded, they should shun both of these candidates. We've heard this tiresome rant before, said Charlotte Allen in the Los Angeles Times. Every time a Christian conservative strives for the presidency, the paranoid intelligentsia warns of a looming theocracy in which adulterers will be stoned, creationism taught in the schools, and gay people sent to orientation therapy. If the U.S. didn't turn into Jesus land under the presidencies of devoted Christians like Ronald Reagan or George W. Bush, why would it under a President Perry or Bachmann? Liberal secularists like Keller aren't really interested in genuine questions of faith, said Michael Medved in the DailyBeast.com. They just want a harumph in supercilious indignation over the simple-minded rubes of the religious right. Their mean-spirited attacks on religion miss the fact that 85% of Americans describe themselves as Christian and don't see a candidate's faith as an issue. The GOP contenders should concentrate on issues that matter to ordinary voters, like the appalling absence of jobs under President Obama, and refuse to take the religion-bashing bait. But it's the candidates themselves who have turned the campaign into a religious auction, said Christopher Hitchens in Slate.com. While crackpot Bachmann has declared Hurricane Irene to be a message from God, current frontrunner Perry has called prayer meetings, quoted scripture at political rallies, and branded evolution an unproven theory. These dog whistles to the congregation may help the Texas governor win the nomination, said Kathleen Parker in the Washington Post, but not the presidency. Most Americans prefer their presidents to keep his religion close and aren't impressed when candidates peddle the kind of literal-mindedness that leads straight to the Dark Ages. So let's keep the fear of theocracy in perspective, said Ross Dutat in the New York Times. Accusing Michelle Bachmann of being a budding Torquemada just because she once met a Dominionist preacher is playing the same paranoid 6 degrees of separation as right-wingers who believe Obama is secretly controlled by his former Chicago preacher, the Reverend Jeremiah Wright. The reality is that zealous Republicans tend to ignore their religious constituents as soon as they take office. Bush, for example, dropped the gay marriage issue almost completely after using it to rally evangelical voters in 2004, and Perry was listening to pharmaceutical lobbyists, not religious conservatives, when he mandated the Texas teenagers be vaccinated against sexually transmitted diseases. The Christians' right, Manichaean rhetoric, grandiose ambitions, and apocalyptic enthusiasms are evidence not of its coming triumph, but of its persistent disappointments. And now let's turn to the popular column in the Week magazine called Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. It was a good week for examples. After Fresno County School Superintendent Larry Powell cut his own annual salary from $290,000 to $31,000. If we face mid-year cuts, I can have the money ready to go and it doesn't affect our employees, Powell said. It was a good week for Al Gore's next home after engineering students at Northwestern University designed a green 128-square-foot house, which includes a living room, a bedroom loft, a kitchen, a composting toilet, and a rainwater filtering system. And it was a good week for parents after an Illinois appeals court dismissed a lawsuit by two grown children who sued their mom for bad mothering, claiming she failed to buy enough toys, haggled over the amount spent on party dresses, and sent a birthday card that her son didn't like. And it was a bad week for bad manners after an attempted bank robbery was foiled by angry customers who scolded the robber for cutting ahead of the line. When a teller told a man to take off his hoodie and wait his turn, he left the bank. It was a bad week for the Australian Navy, which bought a new anti-submarine torpedo system for about $700 million from European manufacturers, and then discovered that the instruction manual was only in French and Italian. The Navy now has to spend at least $100,000 on a translator. And it was a bad week for representing your school after the clothing chain Old Navy began selling official college T-shirts that say, "Let's go," followed by the school name, with the "let's" missing its apostrophe. More than 70 colleges have their names on the T-shirts. And so much for Good Week 4, Bad Week 4 for this week. You're listening to our reading of the Week magazine here on the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thank you for joining me today. Let's turn to the People's section of the Week magazine right now. The first item is entitled Mirren's Straight Arrow Tendencies. "Helen Mirren isn't the libertine she's cracked up to be," said Andrew Goldman in the New York Times. "The legendary actress, 66 years old, has always had a reputation as a risk-taker and a free spirit, beginning with her days in the Royal Shakespeare Company in the swinging 60s, when she earned the nickname the Sex Queen of Stratford. I think that was created independently of what I was doing," says Mirren. "It wasn't something that I created or that came from my behavior. I was just a really hard-working, dedicated young Shakespearean actress." Director Trevor Dunn has famously said that she showed off up to her Royal Shakespeare audition wearing a skimpy black outfit, an assertion that she denies. "That was a product of his imagination. I didn't own anything like that." She was briefly a party girl, but stopped doing cocaine 20 years ago when she realized its production caused violent conflicts. "That's the issue you forget when you're having a lovely time at a party," she says. "The bottom line is that her acting career has been an attempt to conquer her prudishness. I see myself as a boring person," says the actress. "I'm constantly searching to liberate myself from my own insecurities and my own uptightness. I think a lot of my work has been a weird attempt to liberate myself, but it's not altogether successful." And the next item from the People's section, The Rhinestone Cowboy Battles Alzheimer's. Glenn Campbell is fading fast, said Patrick Doyle in Rolling Stone. The singer and guitarist, 75 now, recently announced that he's suffering from Alzheimer's disease, and it's already starting to take his memory. I do get confused, he admits. While performing, he has found himself unable to recall some of the lyrics to his 1975 hit, Rhinestone Cowboy, which he calls maybe the best song I've ever sung. He's now planning to release an album and go on tour as a final chapter in a long musical career. That career began when he played with such stars as Elvis and Frank Sinatra, and then peaked with a solo career in which he produced several major hits. He even replaced Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys for a while after Wilson suffered a nervous breakdown. Certain periods are fuzzier than others. He doesn't remember his 16-year marriage to his second wife, Billie Jean Nunley, or his cocaine-fueled nights with singer Tanya Tucker in the 70s. There are times he can't even remember that he's been diagnosed with Alzheimer's. I don't even know where that came from. I haven't been to the doctor in years, he said. I guess I'll wait till it hits me, then. Michelle's unlikely success. Lea Michele isn't your typical Hollywood it girl, said Marshall Heyman in Harper's Bazaar. Unlike so many of her peers, the 25-year-old actress and singer didn't find her way to fame through the Disney Channel or American Idol or YouTube. Instead, she did it the old-fashioned way on the Great White Way. She got her first role on Broadway in Les Miserables when she was 8 years old, and her big break came at 19 when she was cast in the musical Spring Awakening, which won the Tony for Best Musical. But getting people to take her seriously as an actress has been a challenge, says Michelle. I'm 5'3". I don't look like a lot of other people, you know what I mean? I look like I'm 12, and then there's her nose, which is by Hollywood standards Streisand-esque. How many managers told me, get a nose job, you're not pretty enough. But I proved them wrong, she says. She's done so primarily with her singing voice, which is also somewhat Streisand-esque, as showcased on the television show Glee. Soon she'll be starring in a film version of the show, in 3D, she says with a laugh. My nose is going to look fabulous. Now let's turn to the briefing section in the Week magazine this week. It's entitled Obama's Election Guru. David Plouffe, who ran Barack Obama's 2008 campaign, is now shaping White House policy. What is his strategy? Who is David Plouffe? He's now a senior advisor to the president, the man in charge of the White House's message machine. Little known outside of Washington, Plouffe is widely regarded as the most talented strategist in the Democratic Party. After spending most of his career in campaign roles, Plouffe was brought into the White House earlier this year to help craft policy. His move into the West Wing was widely seen as an indication of how worried Obama and his other advisors are about his reelection, especially with the unemployment likely to remain at around 9% right up to November 2012. With the relentlessly pragmatic and detail-oriented Plouffe now shaping Obama's image on a daily basis, political considerations play a part in every decision the White House makes. Everything is about the reelect. An insider who's seen Plouffe's influence firsthand told the New York Review of Books, where the president goes, what he does. What's his background? Well, Plouffe made his mark directing campaign efforts for Iowa Senator Tom Harkin and then managed campaigns for Democratic candidates in Massachusetts, Delaware, and New Jersey. When he became Obama's campaign manager in 2007, Hillary Clinton was the party's presumptive nominee and had much of the party leadership behind her. Plouffe realized that if Obama could defeat Clinton in Iowa, the first primary state, he would put himself on the map as a serious contender. Then, rather than focus on Super Tuesday a month later, Plouffe dispersed resources to usually ignored smaller states, picking up delegates who were critical to Obama's victory. In the general election against John McCain, Plouffe also went against conventional wisdom by deploying resources to virtually every state, which forced the Republican candidate to fight for GOP-friendly turf in the South, the West, and suburban areas that Democrats had historically ceded. David is just very organized, very smart. He always has a plan, and then he executes a plan in a methodical way, said former House Majority Leader Richard Gephardt, for whom Plouffe served as Deputy Chief of Staff in 1997 and 1998. What is his mission for 2012? Winning back independent voters, Obama secured 52% of their votes in 2008, helping him take traditionally Republican states such as Indiana and North Carolina. But independents deserted the Democrats in the 2012 midterm elections, and Obama's approval rating among swing voters now stands at 35%. Democratic strategists believe that Obama alienated many independents who typically dislike partisan quarrels during the fierce battles over health care in 2009 and 2010. He further disappointed them with his inability to kickstart the economy. Acutely mindful that the center is where presidential elections are usually won, Plouffe has tried to position Obama as a non-ideological leader who's free of the stale ideas of the left or right and focused on what's going to be right for the country. Says Plouffe, compromise isn't a dirty word. Is this approach popular? Not with liberals. Christina Romer, former chair of the President's Council of Economic Advisers, warns that Obama's fear of confrontation is letting Republicans control the agenda. If the president doesn't propose a major jobs or stimulus program soon, she says, the economic malaise will continue into 2012, and then it's awfully hard to get reelected. Other Democrats worry that the president's constant compromising has disheartened the party's base, especially young idealists. I know a lot of the kids who worked hard in 2008, says W. Hodding Carter III, a former advisor to President Jimmy Carter. They walk around like cattle who've been hit with stun guns. What will be Obama's main message? With the economy in the doldrums, Team Obama will focus on the character of his Republican opponent. If that nominee is former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, an insider told Politico.com recently, Obama's campaign will try to portray him as a weird and inauthentic candidate who has flip-flopped on everything from abortion to universal health care. He's a world-class political contortionist, says Plouffe. Should Texas Governor Rick Perry win the nomination, Obama will likely paint him as a Tea Party radical and a hypocrite who talks small government but hands out millions in state contracts to cronies and campaign contributors. Obama, meanwhile, will be presented to voters as a trustworthy man of character and maturity, the only adult in the room. Will that strategy work? It's early, but at this stage, the White House has a lot of minds to change. Most independents polls show were unhappy with Obama's debt ceiling compromise, and many question his toughness. A recent Gallup poll of registered voters showed that in a hypothetical election, Romney would beat Obama by 48% to 46%. Perry, meanwhile, would tie with Obama at 47%. Independents preferred both Romney and Perry to the president, but it's 15 months before November 2012, and Plouffe knows a lot will happen in that time. It's going to be a very close competitive election, he says, a street fight for the presidency. And the related item here in the briefing of the week section, meanwhile, in Chicago, the election is still 15 months away, but the president's campaign office is already up and running in the Windy City. Dozens of social media experts, digital strategists, fundraisers, and phone bank volunteers are now working at Obama for America's 50,000-square-foot Chicago office, which opened up shop in April. The campaign is already delivering on fundraising. In the 3 months leading up to July, Obama collected $86 million, more than all of the Republican candidates combined. By the time the election rolls around, many experts predict Obama may have raised and spent a total of $1 billion. This is the first time in four decades that an incumbent president has tried to win re-election with a campaign headquartered outside Washington. But being based outside the Capitol, says David Axelrod, Obama's chief strategist in Chicago, allows staffers to concentrate on their mission and not get distracted by the day-to-day yammerings of the punditocracy in Washington. And now let's turn to the best columns of the U.S. this week in The Week magazine. Our first one is entitled, Why Perry is Leading the Pack, and it's written by David Brooks in The New York Times. Texas Governor Rick Perry's appeal is not just a summer fad, said David Brooks. It's time to take him seriously as a candidate and as a potential president. Less than 3 weeks after he charged into the race for the Republican nomination, Perry is polling better than his GOP rivals and is neck and neck with President Obama. His gun-toting, Bible-loving, small government swagger is perfectly tuned to an electorate that has swung to the right after Wall Street bailouts and the failed stimulus. Republicans now hold an 11-point advantage over Democrats with under 30 white voters, according to the Pew Research Center. 3 years ago, 63% of GOP primary voters called themselves conservative. Today, it's 73%. The only issue that matters to this new majority is ending big government, and that is Perry's simple and fashionable message. Romney is waiting for Perry to implode, but the Texans' gaffes only endear him to his base. Moderates of both parties would be wise not to underestimate the timing and the power of the Perry surge. He could be our next president. The next column is entitled, Let's Stop the Thought Police on Campus, by Robert Shibley in the New York Post. Our college students are being brainwashed, said Robert Shibley. University administrators across the U.S. are turning freshman orientations into politically correct re-education programs, where 18-year-olds are told that all men are rapists, all white people are racists, and all minorities are victims. Students at DePauw University in Indiana were forced last fall to witness realistic demonstrations of behaviors that the PC Brigade believes are widespread, such as religious parents hating their gay children and non-Muslims victimizing Muslims. Male students at New York's Hamilton College, meanwhile, were herded into a presentation entitled She Fears You, where they were urged to acknowledge their complicity in the college's rape culture. Such Orwellian thought reform is certainly not the education most parents expect their children to receive in their first month on campus. So warn your children to avoid college-sponsored indoctrination and remind them that they are free to make up their own minds about such complicated issues as race, sexuality, and religion. College is supposed to teach you how to think, not what you must think. And the third column is entitled Cheney's No Regrets Memoir by Robert G. Kaiser in the Washington Post. Dick Cheney's new memoir, In My Time, would more aptly be titled I Was Right About Everything, said Robert Kaiser. Even judged by the low standards of the statesman's memoir genre, this book provides little self-analysis, candor, or even news. To fill its 576 pages, the former vice president revels in endless self-congratulations about his 8 years co-presiding over one of the most hapless administrations of modern times. He continues to link Saddam Hussein to al-Qaeda and blindly defends the enhanced interrogation techniques that the world has since labeled torture. What's notable about this memoir is what it leaves out. Cheney skirts around Richard Clark's early warnings about al-Qaeda and the administration's failure to capture Osama bin Laden. He takes no responsibility for the disastrous decision to divert resources from Afghanistan to the fiasco of the war in Iraq, or for helping George W. Bush squander the nation's budget surplus. Like the self-serving memoirs of Bush and Donald Rumsfeld, This book will frustrate leaders seeking to understand a pugnacious administration and the world-changing messes it left for its successors to clean up. And now we'll move on toward the back of the Week magazine for this week to the article entitled The Last Word. And the specific title for this week's edition is The Birth of the High Five. Who invented the celebratory gesture? A baseball player later shunned by the sport itself, says John Mualim, who is the writer of this article. It was October 2nd, 1977, the last day of the regular season, and Dodgers left fielder Dusty Baker had just gone deep off the Astros' J.R. Richard. It was Baker's 30th home run, a wild, triumphant moment as the Dodgers headed to the playoffs. Glenn Burke, a young outfielder whose astonishing physique and 17-inch biceps earned him the nickname King Kong, was waiting on deck. In front of 46,000 screaming fans at Dodger Stadium, Burke thrust his hand enthusiastically over his head to greet his friend at the plate. Baker, not knowing what to do, smacked it. His hand was up in the air and he was arching way back, says Baker, 62, who's now managing the Cincinnati Reds. So I reached up and hit his hand. It seemed like the right thing to do. Burke then stepped to the plate and launched its first major league home run. And, as he returned to the dugout, Baker high-fived him. From there, the story goes, the high-five went ricocheting around the world. This simple, timeless gesture, it seems, was invented then and there in Dodger Stadium by Burke, though sadly, the game was not televised and no footage survives of the first man to go up top. The high five was a natural outgrowth of Burke's personality. The Oakland native was an irrepressibly charismatic man who, even as a 24-year-old rookie that season, had become the soul of the Dodgers clubhouse. He did Richard Pryor stand-up from memory and would stuff towels under his shirt and waddle bow-legged around the dugout, imitating Dodgers manager Tommy Lasorda. He was a joyous, gregarious person, says sport agent Abdul Jahil Al-Hakim, a friend since childhood. What most people didn't know was that Burke was gay. Following his retirement in 1980, he became the first major leaguer to come out. Even though he tried to keep his sexuality a secret during his playing days, there had been rumors in the clubhouse. And as the 2010 television documentary Out, the Glenn Burke Story revealed, Dodgers executives scrambled to squash these rumors at all costs. In the off-season of 1977, team VP Al Campanis offered Burke $75,000 to get married. According to a friend, Burke rejected the marriage deal with a mix of wit and rebelliousness. He told Campanis, "I guess you mean to a woman." It was around that time that Burke struck up a relationship with Spunky Lasorda, also known as Tommy Lasorda Jr. Spunky was a lithe young socialite who frequented West Hollywood's gay scene, smoking cigarettes from a long holder. A 1992 GQ profile of Spunky portrayed his homosexuality as an open secret. But his father was in staunch denial and remained so even after Spunky's death in 1991 from pneumonia. GQ reported that the death certificate said his illness was likely AIDS-related. "My son wasn't gay, no way," Lasorda Sr. told the magazine. Burke and Spunky's relationship didn't become public until years later and remains ambiguous. Burke's sister, Lutha Davis, insists the two men were just close friends. In his 1995 memoir, Out at Home, co-authored with Eric Sherman, Burke went out of his way to leave the true nature of the relationship unclear. "That's my business," he wrote, and also explained that Lasorda Sr.'s homophobia was something he and Spunky commiserated about. Burke described them turning up together at Lasorda's house one night, done up in pigtails and drag, hoping to stage a kind of gay guess-who's-coming-to-dinner. They chickened out before knocking on the door. Whatever the case, Burke's association with Spunky marks the point at which his big league career took an irrevocable left turn. Lasorda stopped being amused by the player's dugout antics and, according to Burke, turned on him. Glenn had such an abundance of respect and love for Tommy Lasorda, says Burke's sister. When things went bad at the end, it was almost like a father turning his back on his son. Early in the 1978 season, the Dodgers abruptly dealt Burke to the Oakland A's, among the most lackluster teams in baseball, for Billy North, an outfielder past his prime. L.A. sports writers described the trade as sucking the life out of the Dodgers clubhouse. A couple of players were seen crying at their lockers. For Burke, the trade had everything to do with his sexuality, though the outfielder sounded off to the press about it only in the most cryptic terms. "I never got a chance here," he said. "I felt I was supposed to kiss ass, and I didn't." After unproductive years in 1978 and 79, Burke hoped for a fresh start in 1980 under new A's manager Billy Martin. But the gay rumors followed Burke to Oakland. Martin threw the word faggot around the clubhouse and didn't play Burke. Some teammates even avoided showering with him. Burke, accustomed to being the heart of the clubhouse, felt crippled by the discomfort he was causing. His unhappiness was compounded by a knee injury and a demotion to AAA. After playing just 25 games in the minors in 1980, he abruptly retired. He was 27 years old. "It's the first thing in my life I ever backed down from," he later said. Burke started hanging around San Francisco's Castro District. He became a star shortstop in a local gay softball league and dominated in the Gay Softball World Series. "I was making money playing ball and not having any fun," he said of his time in the majors. "Now I'm not making money, but I'm having fun." Jack McGowan, a friend in the Castro, who has since passed away, once said of Burke, "He was a hero to us. He was athletic, clean-cut, masculine. He was everything that we wanted to prove to the world that we could be." In the Castro, Burke's creation of the high five was part of his Herculean mystique. He would flash his magnetic smile and high-five everyone who walked by. In 1982, he came out publicly in an Inside Sports magazine profile called The Double Life of a Gay Dodger. The writer, a gay activist named Michael J. Smith, appropriated the high five as a defiant symbol of gay pride. Rising from the wreckage of Burke's aborted baseball career, Smith wrote, was a legacy of two men's hands touching high above their heads. By that time, however, Burke was struggling with a drug habit. It escalated in 1987 when a car plowed into him as he was crossing a street, breaking his right leg in four places and stealing his athleticism. He couldn't hold a job. He went broke. He did some time in San Quentin for grand theft. Then in 1993, he tested positive for HIV. He passed away on May 30, 1995, after a sharp and grisly decline. One obituary noted that at the end, the man who invented the high five could barely lift his arm. As Burke's life sputtered downward, the high five madly ascended. Even by 1980, the Dodgers were selling high five T-shirts with a trademarked logo of two upraised hands connecting. It wasn't just L.A. The high five was being celebrated as a welcome injection of style throughout sports and in everyday life. "The high five liberated everybody," says Abdul Jahil Al-Hakim. "It gave you permission to enjoy your high points, and not just in sports, but at your kid's spelling bee or your office after a killer PowerPoint presentation." In this interpretation, Burke didn't just add a bit of flair to baseball. He uncorked a repressed longing for personal expression and connection in all of American society. Years after Burke died, his sister, Lutha Davis, was watching Jeopardy when a question about the inventor of the high five popped up. "People who knew Burke have always known the truth," she told me, "but it was gratifying to watch some anonymous Midwestern-looking contestant buzz in and say with unflappable certainty, 'Who is Glenn Burke?'" It's nice to believe that something as magnificent and durable as the high five could be invented only once in a romantic, unforgettable fashion. The truth is, such things are invented many times by many people, multiple mythologies rewritten over time. I've come to realize this happens in my research for the first high five. I happened upon a second entirely credible story of its birth. It goes like this. At a University of Louisville basketball practice during the 1978-79 season, forward Willie Brown went to give a plain old low five, a knee-high hand slap, to his teammate Derek Smith. Out of nowhere, Smith looked up, looked Brown in the eye and said, "No, up high." The Louisville Cardinals were known as the Doctors of Dunk. They played above the rim, so when Smith raised his hand, it clicked for Brown. He understood how the low five went against the essential vertical character of their team. "I thought, yeah, why are we staying down low? We jump so high," says Brown, now head coach at Indiana University Southeast. Brown insists it was Smith who invented the high five and Smith who spread it around the country. In fact, high fives do turn up in highlight reels of the 1978-79 Louisville team. Occasionally they're jerky, thrusting fives, more like spears thrown perpendicularly at the other guy's torso. But they're clearly among the first high fives ever broadcast in American living rooms. I couldn't ask Derek Smith about his invention of the high five. After a respectable NBA career, he died suddenly in 1996 from an undiagnosed heart condition. But Brown told me about one particular day at Louisville after Smith got a call about the high five from a big city newspaper. Derek was talking about how this was going to go down in history, Brown says. It would be something we could tell our grandkids and our children. A tiny item in the New York Times on September 1, 1980, mentioned a burgeoning fad called the high five and the man who apparently invented it, Derek Smith. There's no mention of Glenn Burke, even though he also apparently invented the high five 3 years earlier. In fact, aside from Smith and his teammates, there's only one other person mentioned in the story. The piece begins, "Manager Tom Lasorda of the Los Angeles Dodgers has joined the growing list of high-fivers." But the veteran of 35 years in baseball admits he does not know where it all began. "It's just one of those things," Lasorda told the paper. "Who knows?" So here's the question. Did Lasorda purposefully not mention Glenn Burke? Through an assistant, Lasorda reiterated that he doesn't know who invented the high five, but didn't respond to requests for an interview. So, ultimately, the story of the high five is a ghost story about how we remember and how badly we want to be remembered. Glenn Burke walked away from baseball after 4 seasons with a career .237 batting average. But as he told a newspaper reporter years later, "You think about the feeling you get when you give someone the high five. I had that feeling before everybody else." And this article was written by John Mualim, and it was copyrighted by ESPN, the magazine, in 2011. Now let's turn to the section entitled Talking Points, featuring articles that people have been talking about around the United States in the past week. The first one is entitled Apple, the Singular Legacy of Steve Jobs. "It's time to say farewell to the Thomas Edison of our age," said Ken Oletta in The New Yorker. After battling cancer for almost a decade, Steve Jobs announced last week that he was stepping down as Apple CEO. He leaves behind a record unrivaled by almost any other 20th century inventor. The scope of technologies that sprang from Jobs' Cupertino, California laboratories, he brought the first mouse into our homes, as well as the iPod, iPhone, and the iPad, is awesome, as was that from Edison's Menlo Park, New Jersey. And like Edison, Jobs crafted his devices without input from endless focus groups and market research. He understood that consumers didn't know what they wanted because they had no frame of reference for an iPhone that delivered a small miracle as it fit into the palm of a hand. Jobs also balked at other accepted Silicon Valley practices. Microsoft founder Bill Gates and other tech leaders scoffed when Jobs announced that Apple would produce both hardware and software, and laughed again when he said his company would open up its own stores. Today, those other firms are desperately trying to catch up with Apple, now the world's second most valuable company behind oil giant ExxonMobil. So what's the secret of Jobs' success? Asked Derek Thompson in The Atlantic. Although he's a great innovator, Jobs' true genius lies in the mainstreaming of existing ideas. Apple didn't invent the MP3 player. Audio Highway did. But the iPod now dominates the market with over 300 million units sold to date. Apple also didn't develop the first smartphone, but the iPhone redefined what a phone should be. Jobs understands that being first is overrated. What counts is being the best. Apple has stayed ahead of the competition thanks to its boss's insistence on simple, intuitive design, said Nicole McInnes in the Sydney Telegraph. From the company's first desktop computer to its latest iPad, which, like the iPhone, has only one button, every curve and user interface has been crafted to make this technology seem as natural as possible. Ever wondered why a one-year-old can use an iPhone? You don't need a manual. It's just an extension of your brain. Jobs' influence stretches far beyond the tech sector, said David Carr in the New York Times. By placing sexy, irresistible devices in the hands of the public, he's also shaken up the media landscape. The debut of the iPod and iTunes in 2001, for instance, gave music fans a legitimate, easy-to-use alternative to the pirate sites that were threatening to sink the music industry. In the process, Apple brought an end to the album format by allowing people to buy individual songs and shattered record labels' control of the industry. Now the iPad is having a similarly revolutionary impact on publishing. While newspapers and magazines have struggled to create an online mechanism that separates consumers from their cash, Apple has done just that with its easy-to-use App Store, where people can buy content with the push of a button. But will Apple still be Apple without Jobs at the helm? Asked David Pogue, also in the Times. His replacement, former Chief Operating Officer Tim Cook, gets rave reviews as an executive and numbers guy. But is he a Jobs-style micromanaging visionary who can run a $350 billion giant with the nimbleness of a startup company? Would he have had the charisma to convince record labels to sell their music for a dollar a song? Or the crazy confidence to kill off technologies he sees as dying, as Jobs did to the floppy disk drive and the dial-up modem? I doubt it, and that's why we'll likely never see another 15 years of blockbuster, culture-changing hits like the iMac, iPod, iPhone, and iPad from Apple or anyone else. Jobs' resignation comes at a dangerous time for the company, said Catherine Rushton in the London Telegraph. Google's recent purchase of cell phone maker Motorola Mobility signals its intention to take on Apple at the hardware game. Meanwhile, early Apple loyalists, many of whom once loved its underdog status, have started to rebel against its dictatorial approach. Some are switching to Google's open-source Android operating system, which is quickly building up an evangelical Apple-like following. Don't worry about Apple's post-Jobs future, said Felix Salmon in Reuters.com. It's true that he was one of those rare CEOs who really didn't make an enormous difference to the company. But even so, he's just one guy, and his DNA is now baked into the company. Cook might not be a product guru, but Apple's head designer, Jonathan Ive, will be on hand to slice away extraneous features of hardware, say no to the demands of the marketplace, and give us gizmos we never knew we wanted. And anyway, Jobs, who remains company chairman, knows that he will be judged on the smoothness of this leadership handover. I'm quietly confident that he has done it perfectly. Martin Luther King has his dream come true. He had a dream, said Susan Page in USA Today, And now he has a statue, a towering granite likeness of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was unveiled in Washington, D.C. this week, and a recent USA Today Gallup poll showed that a majority of Americans believe King's dream of racial equality has been realized. While most agree that problems remain, and nearly 50% believe that racism will never be fully eradicated, many Americans, both black and white, point to the election of President Obama as the fulfillment of the dream King laid out nearly 50 years ago on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. The statue is a fitting and proper tribute, said Charles Krauthammer in WashingtonPost.com, to the author of one of the miracles of our history. It is a pretty statue, said John Fountain in the Chicago Times, and the thought of a black man in the White House would have made King very proud. But in 21st century ghetto America, King's dream now more resembles a nightmare. Failing public schools, economic degradation, and a pervasive absence of hope are proving even more powerful oppressors of the black community, particularly its young men, than the Jim Crow laws that King helped to overturn. King's monument stands in tribute to the civil rights movement, said Colbert King in the Washington Post, but it should also remind us that King had to fight hard and that resistance to an integrated society is an ingrained part of U.S. history. Race was only part of King's dream, though, said Leonard Pitts in the Miami Herald. People too easily forget that at the time of his assassination in 1968, King was fighting for the right of workers to form a union and for the dignity of the poor, issues as relevant today as they were 40 years ago. To King, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post, justice was not just a legal or moral question, but a matter of economics as well. In this regard, his dream of equality hasn't begun to come true. The gulf between rich and poor in this country is wider than it has ever been, and it is getting wider. King's monument in Washington should challenge our morality, our faith, and our conscience to strive for more and deeper justice, just as the great man himself did 40 years ago. And we have just a few moments left in our program. Let's take a look at some short items from the Talking Points section. Rebels ransacking the Tripoli, Libya compound of Muammar al-Qaddafi found a photo album dedicated entirely to images of former U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice. The colonel's devotion doesn't come as a surprise. In an interview with Al Jazeera in 2007, the Libyan leader referred to Rice as a darling black African woman and said, "Lisa, Lisa, Lisa, I love her very much." The Cadillac Escalade has the dubious distinction of being America's most stolen vehicle. The $63,000 SUV is six times more likely to be targeted by thieves than the average vehicle. And more than 450,000 people have joined a Facebook group called I Hate Reading. A rival group, I Love Reading, has attracted fewer than 45,000 members. And our poll watch this week, the proportion of New York City residents concerned about another terrorist attack is at the lowest point since the World Trade Center attacks in 2001. Currently, 49% of the city's residents remain worried about another attack. A similar poll taken during last year's anniversary of 9/11 found that 56% were concerned about future terrorist attacks. We have just about run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast will be readily available as a podcast right after the broadcast. So long, until next time.